just going to start this one now. So this is Stefan Sembrovic, and it's the 4th of June, 2013, and I'm with Stefan Petrusevic at 152 Wells Way, Bath. Stefan, how does your story begin?
Well, I was born in Vilna in 1930. Vilna, which is now Vilnius, of course, it's the capital city of Lithuania at present. And, well, I was there until my mother died when I was age of five. And my father had to marry again, of course, because having two small children, myself and my sister, he had to have somebody to look after them, after us, that is.
Yes.
And so I had a stepmother. When my mother died, we lived just outside Vilno, but of course we had to move into almost center of Vilno. And then when I was about six, my father, by some means, got me into the school, which was 1 year early, because normally school at in Poland started at seven.
Yes.
Now that was very, very important later, because I gained 1 year of schooling sort of ahead of everybody else. And then, of course, I was at school doing pretty well, and then war started. And the Russians came into Vilno and took Vilno, that part of Poland, at that time. But after 1 month, they ceded Vilno and the district to Lithuania. So we became Lithuania, proper,
yes,
independent Lithuania, for almost 1 year. And my schooling continued in Polish with only one lecture in Lithuanian. So nothing really changed. Schooling was carrying normally. By then I was in the fourth year of school, and then Russian took everybody. Lithuania, Latvia and Estonia in 1940. That was June 1940. And of course schooling continued as usual in Polish, except for one lecture in Lithuanian and one lecture in Russian. So we had three languages, Polish, Lithuanian and Russian. And then, doing quite well, and in June 1941, 14th of June, a nice Saturday, I went to school to find out how I did in exams. That was fifth year, end of fifth year.
You were how old then?
I was 11 then.
Yes.
1941, 11. And I've noticed, I was in Main Street, you know, one of the main streets coming out of Vilno, and I've noticed the Russian sort of lorries coming up and loading up with people. Here, there, and everywhere, and I thought to myself, there's something very odd going on. So, instead, you know, I didn't wait for my results, exam results. I went straight back to home, and I found another lorry standing there. I went into the house, and I found out Lithuanian policeman, Russian uncovered their person, and of course everybody crying. My sister was crying, my mother was crying, my father was rather upset, of course. My very, very young sister was much, that's my stepmother's child, you know, my half-sister. She was much too young to cry or anything like that, but everybody else was crying, and they told me we're going to be deported. Fair enough, so we had to load up all the, you know, things. And then we were told that men and children and women are going to be separated. Men will go separately and women are going to be separately with children. So they took us by lorry to the railway station at Nova Vileka, which is just outside Vilno, actually, loaded up in the cattle tracks, men separately in one of the long trains, women and children in another one. And after standing for about I think about 12 hours, we started to move.
What time of year was this?
That was, as I said, 14th of June, 1941. Beautiful summer. So we had to travel in those cattle trains, 16 in every sort of carriage.
16.
Yes. That's 8, 8, 8, and 8, you know, sort of bunks. We traveled for about 1 week, and the war started, of course, between Germany attacked Russia. We knew something was going on, and then about that time, it was first time they opened the actual carriage doors and we could go out and have some fresh air. Up to that time, we were not allowed to get out at all. Mind you, the journey wasn't too bad because they fed us properly.
Yes.
Weather was perfect, very nice and warm. So, in actual fact, we had so much food given to us that sometimes we used to throw out food to the Russians outside, which is much more different to what it used to be before. Well, about, it took us about 3 weeks to get to the place, and we went through Omsk and Novosibirsk down to a place called Rubtsovka, which is now Rubtsovsk. It's now a fairly large town, but at that time was really sort of a small town, very small town. And there, of course, they disembarked everybody and sent us to a large sort of square, everybody sitting, you know, miserable and, you know, not knowing what to do next. And the NKVD chappy, that's the secret police people, came up and said, you might as well get used to it, sort of start living here because you're never going to get out of it alive, you know, sort of thing. And they sort of divided us into groups and sent, you know, people to different sovkhozes, which is state collective farm. And we were sent to a place called Krupchovsky Chvekva Sovkhoz. Sorry, it's a Russian name. It's sort of a sovkhoz, state collective farm, which used to grow, apart from wheat and all that, sugar beet. That's why it's called Chvekva, which was a sugar beet. To start off with, we were sent to stay with Ukrainian family, which was, of course, same as us, were deported in 1920s, you know. But they, of course, been there for a long time, and they had houses, you know, sort of houses their own. And we stayed with them. That is my mother, my sister, and my half-sister, four of us.
Your father was...
Father was sent completely somewhere else, which we didn't know where.
Yes.
Nobody, they didn't know where we were, and we didn't know where he was. Of course, eventually I found out where he was, yes. So they were all children and women only, no men whatsoever. About a few weeks we stayed with that Ukrainian family. They were very, very nice to us, actually. Very nice indeed. You know, crying with my mother's all the time and all that, and praying and all that lot. And then they collected everybody again and put us in a fairly large sort of hall, about 40 people, a bed, sort of by the bed, everybody together, you know, no divisions or anything like that. And then we stayed there, and women had to go to work. And children, of course, well, we just played around, that's all. I had to look after my half-sister and my older sister, which was younger, because she was 2 years younger than I was. I did all the cooking and all that lot, looking after them. My stepmother worked in the orchard, which was very, very useful because she could get some fruit and all that. And we used to get there, in sovkhoz, the people were not given anything to, you know, not gifts. They were paid actual salary for working, and with that money they could go and buy food.
Yes.
So that was different than, shall we say, kolkhoz, when they were given everything. You know what I mean? No money, only goods. Well, we survived somehow. And then, of course, amnesty came. And I should say about September, we were allowed to leave Siberia and go somewhere south.
So that was September
1941. September 1941. So we just about caught first snows. First snow fell about that time in Siberia. And I remember getting out from the house which we stayed with Russians. It was about about a meter high. And once again, they put us in a train and transported us right down to Uzbekistan. Right down to Uzbekistan by Amudarya, the river called Amudarya, right down south. And they told us to get out, of course. So everybody got out and said, we're going to send you down by boats to, down the river, you work there. And of course, by that time, we found out that if anybody is sent down the river, they never come back again. So everybody said, no, we're not going. We just, went on strike, really. In Russia, we went on strike. Everybody went on strike. I said, no, we're not going to move. So we stayed there for some time. I don't know how long, I'm not sure, about 2 or 3 weeks. Food was given to us, occasionally. Was divided very, very fairly, to the last drop. So nobody could say that it wasn't divided fairly. I remember people having sort of scales and, so weighting that one against the other one.
What sort of food was it? Bread, of course?
Bread.
Black bread.
Black bread.
Yes.
I don't remember really what the food was. I never cared about very much, except I remember I used to go and pinch onions from Uzbeks, from the fields. They were sort of red or purple onions, very sweet. Not the normal onion, the sort of whitish purple, sweet, sugary. Never seen that onion again, never ever. And so they decided, all right, fair enough, if you don't want to stay, go down the river, we'll send you somewhere else. So they sent us to Fergana Basin. That's a very well-known part of Uzbekistan, Turkestan or something like that, one of those republics, just by the Chinese border. It's sort of between the hills. It's very famous. If you look on the map, it's Fergana Basin. And once again, we refused to leave the train. We refused, because we know it's a dead end. End of the line, that's the end, you know what I mean? Once they set us there, we'll never be seen again. So we waited there for about 2 or 3 days. So they sent us back to Tashkent. They told us to get out from Tashkent. Of course, I visited Tashkent, went to the markets there and all that. And we sat in Tashkent, outside the station, for quite a few days. And in actual fact, I have seen the Tashkent station on television quite recently, exactly the same.
Hasn't changed.
Hasn't changed, not at all. So they send us, after that, they said, all right, send us to Jambu, up north, which is now is Kazakhstan, from Uzbek to Kazakhstan. And once again, chucked us out from the train. And we sat there, but that time it was about October, raining, cold, drizzly, uncomfortable, and no food. This time, no food. So we had to sell items of clothing, items like that, to get some money and buy food from Cossacks. We stayed there for about a fortnight, in rain, outside the station. For the last few days, they put us in a hall, small hall, all the families, about 20 of us, all together, children and women. And then, once again, they said, you're going further. So they took us to Vugavoy, which must be about 100 miles from Jambu north towards Almaty. It's called differently now. It's the capital city of Kazakhstan now. Also, almost by the Chinese border, you could see the hills, mountains on the horizon, and the China was behind. They told us to get out once again, and they put us outside the station under, only roof and nothing, no walls at all. We sat there for about a few days in the cold and all that, and then they sort of divided us into different cohorts, which is private collective farm.
Yes.
Kolkhoz. Kazakhs. And about three families were sent to that kolkhoz which I was in. I think three families. And they put us initially with the Kazakhs, you know, with the families for a few days. And then they found empty spaces, so they divided the families separately. And we had a room which is about 3 meters by 3 meters for our, for my two sisters, myself, my mother, and another woman. Don't remember her name. I think she was a countess or something like that. She was very, very sort of standoffish, you know, all that sort of thing. But she was with us for a certain time. So there were five of us sleeping side by side on the floor. Mind you, that was already winter, and we slept there. We never undressed. I don't think I have washed for a long, long time, because you just couldn't wash anywhere, because no facilities whatsoever. Heating was nominal. Food was nominal. I should say we were given 200 grams of grain, mind you, not flour, grain, per child, and 400 grams for working person. So my stepmother was getting 400 grams, and three of us were getting another 600 grams together. So we had 1 kilo of grain per day. And that's all, nothing else. Salt occasionally, but nothing else. No milk, nothing.
How did you prepare this grain?
Well, we used to borrow the milling stones,
yes.
You know, the ones which you have to go round with hand, from the Kazakhs, and that was my job doing it, you know, half a day at least, you know, doing all that. And I was a cook for the family and for that woman too. So what I used to do, I used to get that sort of flour eventually, pour water in it and made sort of dumplings, you know, just water, nothing else,
yes.
And used to dump it in the boiling water, and it became just like glue.
Yes.
You know, you can use that for the wallpapering the room, you know, the
yes.
wallpaper. That was about the consistency eventually. I used to bake sort of bread, you know, flat bread sort of thing what would you call the sagan? You know, sort of half sphere, metallic half sphere cut, sort of like half sphere.
Almost like a wok.
Like a wok,
yes.
Really.
Yes, but very big one, about 1 meter diameter.
Yes,
something like that.
Concave,
like that. And in that you could boil, you could do everything. And
yes.
bake, because the fire was underneath, and that's how it is. I was the cook, getting all the fuel and everything, looking after the family, and that where at Christmas time, my half sister died. You know, right in front of us. Right, you know, she got measles and
pneumonia,
and she died there. My stepmother was distraught completely, and I was very, very distraught about it. You know, because when you have your half sister dying in your hand, you know, it's something. That was very, very.
How
very
old? You were 13 or 14?
That was 1942, 43.
Yes.
Just coming up to
12, 13, yes.
My sister was about 10 then, and my the younger sister was about 4. You know, she died about 4. Well, that was pretty bad, but somehow we survived. And then, of course, we survived like that until about Easter, summertime. By that time, of course, the sugar beet started to come up, because they grow sugar beet. And we used to get sugar beet by hook or by crook. I used to, as a cooking chief, I used to bake it, I used to sort of grate it and you know, sort of bake it again. Oh, it was horrible. If you never tasted a sugared beet boiled or baked, you don't know what awful taste that is. It was something terrible. It was something really terrible. Oh, by the way, by that time, that woman, whatever her name was, left us, and we got another lady with a child, with a girl who was about 7 years old. So there was now five of us in that little room. It was pretty hard, mind you, pretty hard, very cold and very thin. And then, of course, the Polish army was set up. One of the army units was stationed at Mugawoi. And there was official sort of, what do you call it, in charge of it, or civilian, sort of from governmental person, yes, who looked after, you know, everything. And there we could get some food occasionally. My stepmother used to go there and get some bacon or something like that, you know, fat, but not much. But with beet and that you know, sort of flour which I used to grind, we were quite all right. Apart from that, we had nothing, because Kazakhs wouldn't even give us any meat at all. Yes. Not even nothing. No, they just completely and utterly ignored us. They didn't want to have anything to do with us. Nothing. No pity or anything like that.
Why was this?
I don't know. They hated Russians anyway, and yes, we were the same. They thought we were the same.
They thought you were Russian.
Yes.
Yes.
You know, something like that. No, we had no help from them whatsoever. None at all. Actually, there was more help sometimes from a Ukrainian village, which was about 4 kilometers away, where, of course, they had everything. Not everything, but they had gardens, they had orchards, they had everything. Kazakhs had nothing. Just sheep, nothing else. It was just bare. Everything was bare. Nothing. Anyway, to cut a long story short, eventually the Russians allowed the Polish army to get out from Russia, and they tried to manage to get as many sort of civilians and children together as possible. So when the train arrived, they had room and put as many people as they could, and we were very lucky ones to get into that train, and went to Krasnovodsk, which is the port on the Caspian Sea, where, of course, in a typical Russian way, they dropped us about 2 kilometers from the actual port where the boat was, and then told us to march from that point to the boat. So if you had anything to carry, you could only take what you could carry. Everything else was left behind for them, of course. When we got on the boat, that was, I think, what, July 1942, which was transported by sea to Pakhlevi. We called it Persia then, but now it's Iran. Pakhlevi, which is almost opposite Krasnovodsk on the sea. From there, of course, once we arrived in Pakhlevi, it was completely different. We were put in a sort of, not sheds, but, you know, sort of covered buildings, open sides, so you don't get sun. They took everything which you had, you know, dirty, and they gave us new clothing. They gave us food and everything like that. We could wash, we could do everything, because in Russia lice was everywhere. Mm. You know what I mean? You took your shirt and it was all, you know, lice in it. And of course, once they start feeding us, many people, you know, had too much to eat, and they had, you know, dysentery and all that lot. Few died.
Because you'd been almost starving.
After almost starving, you know, when you had too much food, you know what happens. And there I wanted to join the army cadets. Mm. But I was only, 1942, 12 years old.
Yes.
And they only were taking, we didn't know at the time what age was the cutoff. So I went to the actual recruitment of office because the army was there too. And I said I was 1928, added 2 years to my age. So they said to me, oh, very, very sorry, we only take, 15-year-olds, 1927. So too bad. So we had to go to, with my stepmother and my sister, went to Tehran.
Yes.
Which had, I think, about four camps, Polish camps there. And we were sent to number one camp, where all the civilians were transported very recently, the last transport. There were buildings, barracks, very well made, with the bunks and all that. Well, very comfortable, really. Food was quite all right, normal, because they had plenty of food then. But there, once again, I wanted to join the cadets. But this time, even if I was too young, they took me. And that was sort of junior cadets. But for schooling purposes, they took us to Isfahan in Persia, where, of course, all, sort of junior cadets were together and we had schooling. But of course I have learned by that time, and I still wanted to join the cadets. So one convenient day, I managed to get into the office and I altered my date of birth to April 1927.
Right.
Which is adding more than 3 years to my age. Mind you, it wasn't too bad because being part Lithuanian, yeah. I was much taller than everybody else.
Yes, yes.
So, I was actually taller sometimes than the people who were 3 years older than I was. So they took, when they started enrolling for cadets, end of January 1943, of course, 1927, April, perfectly right, because cut-off point was end of January 1927. Just few months, those few months made all the difference.
Right.
And we were transported through Iraq. We stopped at Kanakin, army base.
Kanakin,
that's how it's spelled on the maps. It was a great, big Polish sort of army
base.
And we were Yunaki, we were cadets, on the way to Palestine. So we arrived in Palestine, and as usual, that was army cadets, many, many barracks and Nafi, cinema, very, very nice place, Palestine. Jewish shops around and all that. And there, of course, they decided, to decide where everybody's going to be sent to, either the elementary school, Powszechna, or cadets, the secondary school. And we had to sit the exams. I went to take the exam. I didn't know what the exam it was. I simply took the exam and went to the, the elementary school, which is not the same as English, because you could say the primary school sort of thing. And my name wasn't there. I said, oh, very odd. So I was left standing all by myself, and everybody went, and I was standing there all by myself, because the name was written, but not mine. Hmm. So I went to find out what happened. So they said, you're not here, you're not on the list. So I went to the cadets.
Yes.
Actually, secondary school. I passed wrong exam. So I went higher than they. Now, I was 3 years younger than everybody else, but I was at the same level of education as the other people. Because first, when I was in Vilna, I did not lose any schooling until 1941.
Yes.
I already started 1 year early, so I was 3 years ahead of my own, compared with other people. So they lost 3 years of schooling, I lost nothing.
Right.
So educationally, I was at the same level. So that's why that 1 year, where my father somehow managed to get, got me there. As I said, just after that, just after I passed this exam, I never bothered to go to Kadetska, you know, to the cadets from the barracks which we're in, because there was another exam for Royal Air Force apprentices.
Right.
Lotnicza, you know, Polish Air Force. So I went there and passed that exam and was transported to England to RAF Horton, number one school, RAF Halton.
Horton. Yes.
Horton, number one school of technical training. And we arrived there in September 1943. That was the Air Force school. But we were actually Polish squadron. There were about 200, just over 200 of us. Mm. And we were separated in different, you know, sort of groups. And once again, the exams had to be taken. But amongst all the people there, all the cadets, some of them were looked very young. And of course, I was one of them. Mm. No, by looks. So there were about 16 of us separated from everybody else because the commission thought we were much too young. Because the entry age to Horton should have been 15 and I was only 13. Some of them were about 14, something like that. I was the very, very youngest of the lot. All the people added years to the age, yes, but not as many as I did.
Yes.
And of course, when the commission came, you know very well how you can judge a 13-year-old to 16-year-old, let's face it, you know, straight away. But they couldn't do anything to us at all. What they couldn't send us anywhere, so eventually decided, all right, you can stay, and they kept us at Horton. We spent there about 4 years, just British apprentices used to spend 3 years, but the first year of Horton was actually catching up with everything, physically and, of course, educationally.
Because physically you'd been through starvation.
Oh, starvation. Everybody's undersized, you know, sort of. Mind you, after Palestine, it wasn't too bad, but still we were actually behind physically.
I suppose some of you were ill, things like TB.
Oh, no, not at Horton, no. We had only about two or three cases of TB.
Yes.
Yes, not many, no. So that wasn't too bad, because anybody who was ill, they either died or, you know, sort of sent somewhere else. Very, very few people were ill at Horton. Very few people were ill. Mind you, at Horton, I faked my appendix.
Oh.
I had operation for appendix, because I faked it, you know, because I wanted to have some holiday.
Right.
Marvellous, isn't it? So eventually...
That was ingenious.
That was very ingenious, yes, very, very ingenious.
How did you fool the doctor?
Well, I went, at the right place, at the right time.
Oh.
When he, you know, sort of did things like that, I said, oh. So they took me to hospital, they took it out, and the nurse came up to me, Irish nurse, and also a really ginger one, I said, why did you came to hospital? Your appendix was perfectly all right, you know. Mm. We had to stay in the hospital after operation a full week in bed. We were not allowed to get out.
Right.
And after that, you had another week in hospital walking about, and then you had fortnight holiday. I mean, look at it. Yes. I mean, for that, I could use another appendix if I had one. You know, that sort of thing. Anyway, we were separated into different groups, you know, electricians, instrument makers, armorers, engine people. And because we were the youngest one, we were sent to do aircraft fitting, aircraft fitters.
Yes.
It was technical school, of course. It was technical school. Training for fitters and all that. Mind you, it was very, very, very good school because many of air marshals and air chief marshals and marshals of Air Force came through that school.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Yes. Williamson, who was marshal of the Royal Air Force, went through Halton and then Cranwell.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Quite a few of them when you look at it. One of our... Armitage is my ex-apprentice. He was there when I was. Armitage.
Yes.
Yeah, he's an ex-brat. Same time.
You were called brats?
Oh, yes, we're called brats. Yes, we're called brats. So we're proud to say we are ex-brats. Trenchard and ex-brats.
Trenchard's ex-brats.
Well, I was doing that, and luckily, it is dead lucky that I was doing the aircraft, aircraft engineering, aircraft fitter, because that was very important later. And I passed out as the LIC, top of my class.
LAC, yes.
Leading aircraft man, because when school ended, you could pass out at AC2, which is lowest of the low, then AC1, and LIC is top. Top, you know, above 80% in exams, that was LIC, leading aircraft man. I got the prize for that. And of course, if I were British, then I would have gone to Cranwell for officer's course. But yes. Because I wasn't British, I were not allowed to.
Yeah, because you couldn't be an officer.
No, you
in the British forces.
No, you could
if
no.
you were no, if you no. weren't.
So none of us
British.
So none of us was allowed to go to Cranwell.
Hmm.
No matter how bright you were not allowed. So we had many of us, about 60% or even more, joined the Air Force. I mean. At that time, in 1947, no families, no nothing. What can we do? Just finished school, what can we do? So they allow us to join the Air Force for 5 years. Mm-hmm. So I joined the Air Force and had marvelous time. Went to St. Athens for 1 year.
So, to where?
St. Athens.
Yes.
St. Athens, which is between Bury, just outside Bury, between Bury and Bridgend, you know, sort of South Wales. Then I went posted to different stations. I was posted eventually to RAF Witton, which is Huntingdon. I had my first aircraft to work on, and the next day it crashed. Wasn't my fault.
Right.
Wasn't my fault, but it crashed. My first aircraft I worked on crashed. I mean, really flying aircraft, because at St. Athens was MU, where you did major repairs. So you had never any flying aircraft.
Maintenance unit,
32 yes. MU. Maintenance unit, 32. In maintenance unit, you just repair the aircraft and they take it away and you had nothing to do with it. Mm-hmm. But when you sent to a squadron, of course, you have to work on actual aircraft, flying aircraft. And I was sent there and my first aircraft crashed. Not my fault, engine packed up.
What plane was it?
Lincoln.
Yes.
Lincoln. At 32 MU were meteors. After that, because when you're in the Air Force, you had to do overseas duty. You had to go overseas for at least 2.5 years.
Yes.
So in, what was it now, 47, 48, 40, in 49, spring 49, I was sent to Canal Zone in Egypt. Canal Zone, which was between... near Ismailia,
yes.
On Great Bitter Lake, a place called 109 MU RAF Abiad, where of course was also a repair unit, Spitfires, and later Meteors. There we spent 2.5 years, very nice, sunbathing, sailing, because I joined the sailing club. I had my own boat, on Great Bitter Lake, taking regattas and all that, sailing everywhere. Marvelous. It was quite a good job. Enjoyed every minute of it. Then came back to England. Been sent to another MU and been posted over England, you know. Different station. You break them, we mend them, sort of thing. Right. When they crashed aircraft, we were sent. I had a group of my own. You know, I was in charge of a group, and we went all over the place. I was my own boss. Went to RAF station. Nobody could tell me anything. Mm. Marvelous. I tell my chaps, I had two or three posts with me every time. You know, ex-apprentices. Mm. You know, you say, you're having a long weekend today. You go on Friday after lunch. You know, come back on Monday morning. Don't forget that. Once or twice, I had to send the telegram, you know, because they wanted to, I mean, base, you know, so from home they used to go to base straight away.
Yes.
At Bury St Edmunds. That was the base. After that, when I was demoted, I did a draftsman's course.
Yes.
Draftsman's course at Leicester. And joined the English Service Company at Rugby. As technical assistant, instruction manuals, information, spare part books, all that lot for diesel engines. Didn't like it. I mean, I enjoyed the life, but not the work actually, because it was all paperwork, you know what I mean? And I wanted to go back on the aircraft.
Yes.
Because diesel engines were no interest to me whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So I decided to change the job and got the job with Bristol Aeroplane Company, mind you. Bristol Aeroplane Company, which it was then Aeroplane Company, you know, the BAC.
What year was this?
That was 1956 now. No, sorry, not 1956, 54. Because I joined the English Service in 1953 and joined the BAC in 1954. And I went to Fatigue Laboratory, and they did all the testing on the Britannia 100.
Yes.
And I've done the one, you know, the tank test that used, similar one was done on a Comet in at Farnborough. Mm. We repeated the same test at Bristol on Britannia, you know, pressurizing the actual cockpit. And of course, at the same time, lifting the aircraft as it was flying and sort of pausing it, wing up and down, while pressurized and depressurized, landing again, a sort of takeoff, landing, all that. And I was in charge and designed all the hydraulic for the loading part. Then, in the meantime, I was attending courses at the Technical College and passed my Ordnance National Certificate. Mm. In engineering, of course, at actually Bristol Technical College, got my three distinctions, and been because of that, I've been put up for the state scholarship to go to university.
Yes,
and got a place at Southampton University.
At which university?
Southampton.
Southampton. What? When you were at Bristol Aeroplane Company, did you see anything of the car division?
Yes. In passing only.
Yes.
I've seen the cars going by, but never went in. No, I went in once or twice, but what could I see? A car standing there, you know what I mean? I wasn't interested in cars, I was interested in aircraft. So, you know, when I passed my ONC, Ordnance National Certificate, and got my place at the university 1 year ahead, I applied to Bristol University, so we're not you know, sort of interviewing not until February.
Mm.
So by that time already had placed at Southampton University. Well, 1 year ahead, so I did my first year of high national certificate just for keeping my hand in.
Yes.
And went to Southampton University in engineering. When I joined the Southampton University, there were only 900 students there total. 900. 18 engineering and 900 total. Mm-hmm. Only about a few cars floating about. Everybody knew everybody. I was in Hove Resident as the state scholar. Of course, my grant was bigger. and was allowed to stay 3 years in the Hall of Residence, marvelous place.
Yes.
Hall, you know, Glenair Hall, which was a flat for 5 people, separate rooms with bathroom and everything, and the building itself had 4 flats like that. We had cleaning woman, we had halls in the, you know, every day. Lunch was at the university. Every Sunday was the hall which we had to be. We always had to wear gowns, you know, just like Oxford or Cambridge. You
yes, know? Quite so, formal.
Very formal, except on Saturday. Saturday was not formal, but Sunday lunch was formal. Everybody had to be in gowns, and you had to pray and all that, and you sometimes you had to sit at a high table and all that lot. Marvelous time we had, marvelous time. And at Southampton, I started taking politics in student politics, and became went on to the Students' Council, eventually became a treasurer of the union.
Right.
Treasurer of the union. So, you know, I had a fairly good time. And then, of course, after I got my 2-1, by luck, more or less by luck, by anything else.
Well, it sounds like luck and talent to me.
No, I think it was luck. Actually, I tell you what happened. I woke up at night, you know, so I had a nightmare that a certain question was going to come up.
Yes.
So I looked up and that question came up.
Right.
And that was the main question. I got 60% on that. Or the actual exam, that one question was 60%. And I done it.
That must
if
be.
If you don't call that luck, then I don't know what.
Must be divine providence.
It was, yeah. And then, of course. Yeah, we, after Hall of Residence, you know, after 3 years, we three of us were going to stay longer. Mm. You know, one was going to diploma in English, the second one was doing something else, and I was starting my research into the crack propagation in aircraft structures due to noise, acoustics. And three of us rented a house, actually fully equipped house, from the British Airways pilot who went posted to Middle East and wanted to rent the house for 1 year. So three of us actually rented the house from him, fully furnished, with the cleaning lady and everything.
And of course, this was a very timely piece of research, because at this time there was the Comet Air disaster.
Yes, exactly.
Around about then.
Exactly.
And suddenly this was a vital information.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. And then, of course, as you already know, I had a car by then, Austin 10-1934. Mm. Austin 10-1934.
So it could get from Southampton to London, obviously.
With a clutch which was slipping uphill.
Yes.
45 miles per hour maximum.
Yes.
Yes. So then.
Took some time, but yes, got there.
One of my friends in Southampton, who eventually stood as a Liberal candidate, and that never made it, but he stood as a Liberal candidate, Józef Wiśniewski.
Yes.
He, you know, sort of said, come with me, I want to go to Foley Court, you've got a car, I haven't got a car. He said, he has got a car, let's go, we play bridge all night, you know. So I said, all right, fair enough. I don't want, because I had nothing to do with the Polish community at that time, because I just had no chance being in Air Force, Egypt and all that. You know, I had never had any connection with Polish society whatsoever. Then Southampton, we had no Polish society there either. You know, so you know, I had nothing to do with them. So I said, I, you know, why should I go? You know, Polish students, you know, all that sort of thing. And then, of course, I went there, and there was quite nice place. We danced, and I met my wife there, of course.
And the rest is history.
And the rest is history, yes, quite. And the rest of history. So, as I said before, we got engaged in how many weeks?
Six.
6 weeks, yes. And we married a year later. And, of course, just before we got married, Eva, my future wife, got a job at Winchester. Her second job, what job was it?
Oh, it was obstetrics and gynaecology.
Obstetrics, yes. Yeah. And we lived just outside Winchester in the old thatched cottage. We were filling in a sandwich because the married couple was living there, man and wife, and two daughters. His mother was living in one part, and to divide the two people in one in big house, we were living in the center.
Right.
So they could not go through, you know, because we were dividing them, so that there'd be no argument. So, you know.
Cordon sanitaire.
Quite. That's what we were there. And that was very pleasant, very nice, outside, in the garden and all that. Eventually I got my... ended my research, my 3 years, and got a job at Bristol Technical College, my old college became College of Advanced Technology. Same building, same people and everything like that. So I got a job as a lecturer in engineering, structures, because my subject, structures. That's why I said it was so important that I did, you know, aircraft engineering, you know what I mean? Fit to a aircraft, yes. And not engines or anything like that. Because I knew then, theoretically, and I knew the practical side. I could join them together. When I was talking about structure, how to design things, I knew exactly what I was talking about. So that was very, very important. And eventually the Technical College, or College of Advanced Technology, became University of Bath, and we moved to Bath. When we were in Bristol, I used to take a lot of, you know, part. I used to take part in the Polish Ex-Combatants Association. I was secretary of every committee going, because, you know, the secretary does everything, the chairman does nothing. That's what normally Polish way of doing things. I was always the doer. Anyway, I could write English, I could speak English, I could do everything, I could talk to generals, I could talk to everybody, you know what I mean? Yes. I could do all the organization and everything. So I was secretary every time, you know, with the visiting the generals. General Anders came in. One day, and I remember that we had were going to have lunch, and he said to me, "What wine we're having today?" So I said, "Yes, we are going to have Pommard." "Oh, Pommard," he said, "my favorite wine. Do you want to know why? Do you want to know why he said that?"
"Why?"
"Because when he was in the jail in Lublanka, in Moscow." Yes. When the amnesty came, he was released. He was taken to a room, given marvelous meal with wine which was Pommard.
Goodness.
And he told us that eventually.
Yes.
Well, he told us that.
Because he went to Moscow.
Yeah.
To negotiate.
Oh no, he was there already.
He was there already.
Right. In the prison. They released him from prison.
Then he was locked up. Yes.
Yes. When he was released, he was taken separate to a room, given nice, a lunch with Pommard. And of course, after so many years in jail, you are given marvelous dinner and then wine Pommard.
You never forget it.
Never forget it. And he said, "Oh, my favorite wine," he said. You know, things like that. We had quite a few people visiting and, you know, sort of standards to be, you know, sort of done and all that. So I always doing that, and I was once or twice I was called Hitler because I was always told everybody what to do, you know what I mean?
Right.
You have to do that or else. Because you know how it was in Polish society sometimes. They wanted to do whatever they wanted to do.
Yes.
You know, not listening. I said, "You have to be there at that time because you're meeting somebody, you know, you have to do everything properly."
So you introduced structure.
Yeah. Yeah.
From your engineering experience into the Polish will to do everything.
And that's why I was called a Hitler.
Right. In a complimentary way, I'm sure.
In a way, yes. And of course, after that, I always took part in that life. So it was quite good.
So how many years did your academic career last?
I started in 60, beginning of 63, which I was then 63, 33 years old, and I packed up when I was 67. Mm-hmm. I did two more years.
So 34 years, yes. How do you think your early experiences, and I'd like to ask you both this question, how do you think your early experiences of so much change and turmoil and risk and desperate chances having to be taken, how do you think your early experiences have influenced you for later in life? What effect has it had on you going through all this?
Frankly, if I can be honest, I never thought about it. I just went on with the flow.
Yes.
I never aimed for anything, really. Everything came. So I just went. On the flow. On the tide.
You've described it as luck, but I'm not so sure about that.
No, honestly. It's true. True. I just went with the flow.
Yes, yes, yes.
Everything came my way. I had people to help me. People on the way which helped me. One asked me to go and join the sort of draftsman's course. Yes,
yeah.
I said fair enough. I got in. He didn't. Mm-hmm. Eventually, he did. Sort of thing on that draftsman's course. Things like this. Would you like to be? Would you like to go to university? Of course. But I never aimed for that. What I mean?
Yes, yes.
Never said I go to university because I had different way. I was thinking of doing national higher certificate and then endorsements, which is just about the same level. But when they suggested to me, would you like me to put up for your state scholarship? I said, yes. Know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that.
Whatever you said.
Whatever you said. Honestly, every time like that. My supervisor said, do you want to do research? I said, fair enough. You know what I mean? Every time it was like that.
Education's seems to be a core part of one of Polish culture's core values. Do you think?
Yes, I think it's very important. I think I think parents on the whole take education far more seriously than the average Brit would.
Yes.
And the importance of it, don't you think? They're very ambitious on the whole. Yes.
My dear, I always wanted to be an engineer from the very young.
Yes.
Because in Poland at that time, engineer was at par with lawyer and doctor.
Did you have a role model? Was there somebody, engineer you knew?
No. Nothing like that.
But then you had that mechanical mind.
I had a mechanical mind, yes.
You're interested in how things fit together.
Oh, yes.
How they work.
Yeah, oh, yes. I still am.
Yes.
And when my daughter married, they used to give me all the things to repair. I used to go there and they had the list what had to be repaired there.
They still do.
They used to bring things, for me to repair. Everything.
Not aircraft this time.
Oh, not aircraft. Oh, I can repair. One of my Spitfires is still flying.
Oh.
Yes.
Well, there's not many of those left.
Yes. Yes. When I was doing the jobs on my return from Egypt, I was sent to this travelling MU.
Yes.
And I was sent to RAF Cosford, where they had two last Spitfires flying in.
Yes, RAF Cosford.
RAF Cosford, yes. And there, of course, we had to service them.
Yes.
And one of them is the aircraft still flying. I've got a photograph of it. And it's with the Battle of Britain Memorial flight.
Yes, yes, yes. What did you do to it?
They're quite good. Don't remember now, goodness me. I had two of them. I don't remember which one was which, actually, now.
Yes.
One of them with hydraulic trouble, the other one undercarriage trouble, the other one, all the repairs, One of them had to be assembled again, but that wasn't that one. I don't remember. I mean, one doesn't remember those things when you're doing. You just do a job. I was in charge. I used to do my own things, and my fittest used to do that. I used to, when there's something difficult, I used to do it. But, you just don't remember what it was about. I remember I had to change hydraulics on
it. That was an unfair question.
Very unfair question.
What do you make of the new wave of Poles arriving?
Different people in Thailand.
In what way?
They have different outlook on life. I don't know. Somehow they have different language too. You know, their language is not Polish language anymore. You know, we just can't talk to each other. They have different values. I don't know. They're strange people. Anyway, I'm from Vilna. Oh, by the way, I haven't mentioned that in 1957, when I was a student, I went to Poland for 6 weeks. 57.
My word.
I was one of the brave ones.
My word.
Yes.
Did you have British passport by then?
I had British passport, yes. Because I became British subject in Air Force.
Yes. And where did you visit in 57?
Oh, I was everywhere. We landed in Gdynia.
Yes.
Then I went to Warsaw, to my stepmother's family. Her cousin or something like that. From there, I went to Łomża and to Radziwów. That's where all the problems with the, with Jews and all that. That place, Radziwów. Then then from there I went back to Warsaw again. Then I went to Kraków. Then I went to Wrocław. Oh, then I went to Gdańsk. Oh, goodness me. Częstochowa.
How were living conditions at that time?
Oh, terrible. Yes. Goodness me. Terrible. Mm. I had to stay in the foreign hotels. I mean, hotels for foreigners. I had to pay with dollars and everything like
that. Hard currency, yes.
Yes, currency. But, I mean, in those hotels were quite all right, you know, because I could pay with dollars. But outside, queues, nothing, you know. To get meat or anything, that was terrible. How they managed to get food for me, I don't know. Mind you, when I went to Łomża and Ostrołęka to my brother-in-law's family, they were living in small town villages. They had food.
Yes,
they had that. So they were not too bad. But living in the city, when I stayed with the family of my stepmother, at lunchtime, of course, I can go to restaurants,
yes,
because I could pay with dollars, and I had my lunches in restaurants always, mm-hmm, and things like that, sometimes even suppers. So I could look after myself. But with them, I don't know. Except, you know, when we met all together, all family sort of together, I have no family of my own. Mm. No. The only person who was there died. I didn't know he was there, actually. My father's sort of cousin of sorts, same name, Kazimierz, who was Kazimierz Petrusewicz, who was the minister of Żegluga.
Sailing.
Hmm?
Sailing.
No, it wasn't that. It was the.
Well, it wasn't. It wasn't so bad, actually.
Minister of Żegluga. Minister of
Żegluga. Well, Żegluga is sailing.
It isn't saying it's maritime.
Maritime affairs.
But he was a professor at the in biology, I believe, or something like that, at Warsaw University after the war. Communist. He was in prison in Vilno. Oh. I met him once when my mother died.
Yes.
But if I knew that he was there, I would have visited him. But I didn't. Maybe he wouldn't want to visit from me, you know, I don't know. But he died quite a long time ago now. But it was very, very bad time. When you travel by train, it was just like sardines. You know, people used to climb through the windows and everything like that. But a terrible time. But mind you, it was an enjoyable time, but I still felt a foreigner there. Oh. I felt a foreigner. When I came back to Southampton, because that was between my first and second year at Southampton, I almost sort of knew and kissed the earth.
Mm.
You know, that sort of happened. You know, it was completely different. You know, another country at all.
Have you been back much since?
Oh, quite a few times, but recently, only about 3 or 4 times. But mainly I went to Vilna, my own place, Vilnius.
Yes, yes.
Vilnius, yes. That when I went the first time, I went out and said, this is my place.
Mm.
This is where I belong, really. Really, I felt that. When I walked the street, I felt that. I'm home.